When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest edition of the Royal Blue podcast, and we're all a bit brighter, I think. Today for this one, I'm your host, Chris Beasley, joined by my Echo colleague, the Everton correspondent, Joe Thomas, and our regular guest, Gavin Buckland. I'll start with you, Joe. Huge win, potentially, that one for Everton. I mean, it was everyone wanted a response after Chelsea, and to be fair, I think in many degrees they did get that.
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, one of the things I wrote yesterday was the fact that not only, obviously, were the players able to celebrate a win at the end of the game, but I think they were able to look most supporters in the eye in the stands and you know, just be a general acceptance that they'd improved and that they'd found some degree of a response. I think we need to be wary of kind of lauding the performance too much.
Yeah,
I think that, look, Everton have had a very difficult season. I think a lot of the problems have been self-inflicted, but one thing that I think we've also been consistent in saying is that this club that hasn't had much luck. Yeah. And when I look back on this season, I can think of a lot of games where, you know, 50-50 games, maybe not good performances from either side, but close games between evenly matched sides that ultimately have fallen against Everton. I can also think of a lot of contentious decisions that have gone against Everton. Yeah. And the common refrain from other people, you know, outside the Everton bubble is that these things even themselves out over the course of a campaign. And I'm not quite sure that they do, certainly not precisely anyway, and it's always frustrating to listen to. But I do feel a bit like yesterday, you know, the Forest game was an example of perhaps where those things fell in the right direction on both counts for Everton. I thought it was a relatively even game between two poor sides. I did think Everton were the better side, but I thought that, you know, as we were going towards the half an hour mark and that first, you know, what was Idrissa Gueye's goal, which changed everything, I couldn't have told you which way the first goal was going, and there were times when Forest looked threatening. Obviously the goal changed a lot, but even then, and even with the second goal, you know, it took a massive save from Jordan Pickford. It took Morgan Gibbs-White to miss a big chance. It took two goals from outside the box from Everton. They didn't really create anything in the box. And then you have the three penalty decisions, which are obviously a clear talking point. I'm not going to say all three of them were pens, but I think that, you know, we have seen those decisions go against Everton so many times. It was nice to see them come in Everton's favour this time. So I think that very, very easily, you know, we're starting here celebrating a big win, which really, I think, gives Everton, puts Everton one foot in the Premier League for next season. I think it is that significance. And I think that significance is perhaps why the reaction has been so strong from Forest, because they understand its significance in terms of their plight. You know, there's no doubt that it's important. It takes the pressure off going into a massive week. And we're all happy in Everton and the better for it. But, you know, it wasn't a perfect performance by a great team or anything like that. But they reacted. They managed to react. It was a terrible result and performance against Chelsea. They managed to put something relatively cohesive together. Dyche was bold with a few of his changes. And I think ultimately, you know, things fell in Everton's favour and we'll take that.
Yeah, I mean, as Joe has said, Gav, you know, it's been a tough season. So you can understand Evertonians celebrating a result like this when it comes their way. I mean, is the feel-good factor return for you to a certain degree on the back of that?
I was going to say it's never left me, but yeah. That would be an overstatement, yeah. I think. I'm not sure whether our position at the moment, on and off the pitch, whether you can say there's a feel-good factor, to be honest with you. We're just managing the feel-good factor from week to week, aren't we, really? I agree with Joe's sentiments. After the difficult week, certainly following the debacle at Chelsea, for me it felt like a big win.
Yeah.
The biggest win of the season.
By the magnitude of the result,
some considerable distance. A, it was against Forest. B, it was a weekend where Luton had lost on the Saturday. And then if you get a win here, you know, as Joe said, you got 1-4 in the Premier League for next season, and that's important. And I thought Dyche got a set up right. I like that 4-1. I think that gave us a little bit more. It was quite a brave selection, albeit I think forced upon that the two players dropped Garner and Onana probably both deserved to be dropped after after Monday. It was forced upon them a little bit, but we looked a little bit more, a bit more controlled, a bit more potency in the final third, less reliance on the long ball. It was no coincidence, I think, that McNeil looked far sharper, because we get players in and around him and Harrison as well. You know, rather than playing like sort of 4-4-1-1 and they sat deep, they got further up, and you can get to Corre and Gomez in the round, and we can pass the ball a little bit more in the final third than what we've done this season. As a consequence, you know, if you compare that to Burnley, where it was just lumped the ball forward, I felt we had a little bit more possession, and in the final third, and where it mattered, we supported players far more effectively. And I think Dice needs to be, you know, given a bit of praise for that. And within that, praise for Garner Gay. I thought that one of his best games, you know, since he come back. I thought he was excellent. When he could have been exposed, I think, you know, by being a man, effectively a man short in midfield. And then I thought Dice got the set-up right, and he also got a sub right as well.
Yeah.
I think Garner and Beto, we may talk about, so both changed the game to a degree, and that led to the crucial second goal.
Yeah.
And so from that perspective, the tracksuit of Dyche, I think, had one of his best days as Everton manager. Yeah. I think, to be honest with you, in terms of the setup of the team and the substitutions, and he needed it as well, didn't he?
Yeah,
he needed it.
Yeah, I think we're aware of that, Joe. The full-time whistle was still ringing in our ears, and in the inbox there, the Nottingham Forest tweet appeared. I mean, I was speaking to Michael Baller, we'll come on to that, you know, he's got his column. He thought the account might have been hacked or something, or maybe it was some sort of fake one, but there it was, an official club statement. I mean, what were your thoughts when you saw that for the first time?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. I think it's desperate. I think it's shambolic. I think it's embarrassing, and I think, you know, it really, they are a club that has taken the unusual step of employing a former Premier League referee in Mark Clattenburg to advise their decisions, and yet their decision making seems to have got worse on this front. You know, it's a club that's still dealing with the fines and the bans for coach Stephen Reid from its complaints over the decision when it played Liverpool last month.
Yeah.
And really, it's not really behaviour that's befitting of any kind of professional institution with a reputation that it should want to uphold. I can understand their frustration that we've all been frustrated with VAR and refereeing decisions this season. And, you know, I think the big failure is this belief that Forest have been unfairly targeted, because, you know, I think that really the one thing that's been consistent is a relatively poor competency when it comes to poor competency to on the field decisions, and then a lack of consistency with the application of VAR and the interpretation of some of those rules. I think that's where the issue lies. I think they're wrong to question the integrity of a Premier League referee and the way they're doing for Stuart Atwell. I think, you know, whatever we think of them, they're professionals at the very top of their game, and I think that they deserve the benefit of the doubt, being able to put allegiances aside. You know, I think they can criticise competency fairly, but integrity, I think, is a different matter, and I think that statement will be problematic for them going forward. I also think it's astonishing that the tack that... I'm really, really confused by Nottingham Forest. For my book, when you looked at their four-point deduction and the reasons behind their four-point deduction, I thought that their sentence was very lenient compared to what Everton got. Now, actually, once you got the two-point deduction for Everton, you perhaps saw some of those things evening themselves out. So, but compared to how hard the Everton's first defence was considered and determined, they felt like real leniency when Forrest were doing that. So I was surprised by their decision to appeal that.
Yeah.
Because I think 4 points was fair when you compare that to what Everton did, and you compare to how Forest breached those. The fact that it was clearly, it was a deliberate breach. You know, it was a planned one with delaying the sale of Brennan Johnson, knowing that that would take them into non-compliance. When you think that they got their sentence reduced for their extraordinary cooperation with the Premier League, to then go and appeal it and kick off at the judgment, were strange.
Yeah.
And then you look at how things have continued since then, and now we this gets taken to battle over decisions, and we see the statement again. This idea that this is a club that's willing to cooperate to extraordinary lengths with the authorities in order to find the best way through this chaos is adopting this tactic. I just try to figure out what's changed in the past few weeks, and also just wondering just how much it might come back to haunt them. I mean, you know, I'm concerned that Everton appealed their 2-point decision, because again, I think that could have been a lot worse. And I think we seem to all be operating on the idea that there's a soft signal. Someone's given these clubs the impression that there is no danger of their punishments being increased. I can only think that must be the case in vote of appeal. Yeah. But I feel like with Forest, obviously, you know, VAR complaints shouldn't mar the other thing. But for a club that's may well stay up this season, for a club that is only out of the relegation zone because of the benefit it was given for cooperation with the authorities, to have then embarked on this course of conduct since that verdict, yeah, I think is a very risky business. And I just don't understand. I don't see the sense in it.
Yeah. Gav, could you believe what you were reading when you saw it?
I said to you before you came in, that another Royal Blue podcast we end up talking about Nottingham Forest, isn't it? I didn't agree with the way it was phrased, but I can understand frustrations. Yeah. I think that there's just a lot of frustration about football from week in, week out. That changes from, you know, it's gone to VAR and the way it's operated, from the abandonment of friendlies in the FA Cup,
yeah,
to PSR, chaos, whatever you call it. It just moves from one thing to another. And there's a lot of frustration out there amongst all football clubs, almost just all football clubs at the moment, that manifests itself in many different ways. You know, from cards and ground and stuff like this to tweets that looks always done like a 11:30 of a Saturday night when you've had a couple of too many pints to wake up the next morning.
It's the type of thing, yeah, that you hope that when you've had a bit to drink, you write in your notes rather than it never gets the published date.
You've been on eBay and you found out the next folder, did they really buy that? You know, and I think there's a couple of phrases in there, wasn't there? We're considering our options, what options are there really at this stage?
Threatening, wasn't it, really?
But at the same time, I do get the frustration, and they could have been far better, they could have worded it better thing to get their message far more across far more effectively. Regarding the Atwell stuff, I sort of get that. Coming from a generation when, Chris, you may remember this, when you had the referee at the start of the game and the men who were called linesmen as well, you were told in the programme and on the television where they were from, to show that actually they have got nothing to do with today's teams, just to reinforce that, you know, the neutrality impact. And on that basis, I think the Atwell, given Atwell that game, was a mistake, not because of his, you know, we're questioning his, you know, and he's got any bias at all. It's the fact that if something does go wrong during the game, or there is a mistake that appears to be made, is, you know, it then gives people the armoury to give stick to the process. And I get that. And that's what's happened there. They should remove that by just giving the game to somebody who, to all intents and purposes, is a neutral. So I think that I get what they're saying is there. I also think it opened up a few questions about VAR, again, about referees being VAR, and, you know, it should be a totally neutral thing. The people who operate VAR shouldn't be referees. And
I've not heard you say that before.
I think the two things should a clear demarcation between the two. Uh-huh. That actually, you operate VAR, you are not a referee. Uh-huh. You know, or you may be a referee, but you're not a Premier League referee.
Right, I see.
Yeah, because there's dangerous relationships there, isn't it? And I've maybe before your time, Joe, spoken about, like, you know, I do you a favour in that game, and the next game you do me a favour. Also, as well, at the hierarchy of referees is important. It's not sort of like Anthony Taylor's regarded as being maybe the best referee in the country. If you're a referee who's lower down the food chain, will they overturn?
Okay,
the decision. It's just like, it's like being in work, isn't it? Do you question your boss? If your boss says something, disagree with it, I might not.
So you'd almost them. So what you probably think would be a better solution would then be to have almost two pools of Premier League quality referees, and one of them were from Stockley Park throughout the season, and you have one
on
the pitch.
Maybe they could be retired referees.
I've said before,
they're not deemed young enough to run around the pitch anymore, but they've got that experience of officiating at the highest level.
You know, when you're interpreting, and I know we're going off subject here, but I think it's still relevant to the discussion. When you're interpreting images, why don't you have like a sort of retired photographer or something like that who understands framing and, you know, the way things sort of look on a screen, and stuff like that. But there needs to be a clear demarcation and neutrality between VAR officials and Premier League referees as well, just to ease the burden on Premier League referees, because you hear things, don't you, such and such, you know, don't give us that penalty today, and next time I'll look after you. You know, you hear stuff like that, and I think that we need to remove that risk of that happening. But I do definitely think the hierarchy is a dangerous thing. That junior officials, it's maybe new to the profession in the Premier League, will they overturn a decision made by? I mean, let's name names here. I'm not saying this would happen. Just as like Michael Oliver or an Anthony Taylor, would they? And there's no sort of Anthony Taylor was the referee yesterday, wasn't he? And I get all that, and that's been the most frustrating thing about VAR is you can remove that issue. Mm. I don't like the idea of serving Premier League officials operating VAR at the same time, because it's open to all sorts of leaves you open to all sorts of accusations. And I don't think that came into play yesterday, but I wouldn't have had that. Well, I wouldn't have given it a Luton support.
Yeah.
You know, just basically not that. Think he's not up to it. It's just the fact that actually, if something did go wrong, it leaves you then open to accusations, and that's exactly what's happened. That's damaging, and that could have stopped completely by not giving them the game in the first place. And that goes for every other game.
Yeah. You're right what you say there, Gav. Like you say, on the geographical instances, just don't put the people in that position if you know he's a Luton Town fan. Because we've had it recently, like you say, in days gone by, they'd always be from, you know, a third place in the country, whereas now it's been accusations. You've got the likes of Taylor, and there's other ones, or Greater Manchester officials, and they've officiated City and United games. Yeah. And whether it's the old one, well, he supports Saltringham, and people say, oh, well, of course he does, or whatever. Yeah. Just don't put them in that position, in the first place.
Yeah, it reminds me of the great one that this is going off on the tangent. Ray Lewis was a referee years ago, you know where he came from? Great Buckham.
Is that where all the referees come from?
Yeah. What a great name for a referee to come from. Great book. I think getting back to this point, Forrest's arguments could have been far more effective and far more appreciated if they'd gone down those sorts of lines. As it happened, they just went straight for the nuclear button, didn't they? Straight away, and it all looked a little bit a little bit awry. Coming from a club, strange enough, whose most famous manager was very supportive of referees, would not give his players any opportunity to give sticks to referees on the pitch.
Yeah, I think it's been said about Brian Clough, it reflects on his legacy. But going back to the game itself as such, Jordan Pickford, obviously it was a big day for Jordan Pickford. He'd had along with the rest of the defence, the 6 goals shipped at Stamford Bridge, but of course one came from his direct mistake. What a save that he made, Joe, although it'd be interesting to know what Sean Dyche actually felt of him turning around and celebrating that save while the ball was still in play.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite fantastic, wasn't it? Before we get on to Pickford, is it worth us discussing whether the free penalty decision was
I wasn't going to put you on the spot in that respect. If you want to go through those one by one, then fair enough.
I'll give my view, and then, you know, people can... So the first one, Ashley Young on Gio Reyna. He catches him in the area. Now, I get the opportunity to ask for explanations from VAR in games, and in relation to that one, my understanding is that it wasn't deemed enough to be a serious error. I think I agree with that. I don't think it was a clear error. Mm. The contact was deemed to be minimal, and I think a crucial fit part of this decision, and I think this is relevant, is that VAR, or the refereeing body, believe that it was a decision that was consistent with recent decisions in the Premier League. And that's crucial for me, because I think at the end of the day, he has made contact. You know, Reina might have gone down easily, but there is cause to potentially give a penalty for there. But when I look at that, consistency is key, because I think of James Garner 2 weeks ago against Burnley, when he didn't get it, and I thought it was more contact in a very similar situation. And I also think Tyler Adams gets Dominic Calvert-Lewin at Bournemouth as well. So I could see why a penalty, I could see why Forrest would be frustrated. I'd want it for myself. But when I look back on recent decisions, I think, you know, ones that Everton didn't get, I think it was fair to not overturn it. I do think, and I think this is one of the many issues with VAR that we're seeing, is it seems like the thresholds for intervention and for what is a penalty, and I think we're particularly seeing this on handball and minimal contact ones, is it seems like the interpretation is changing over the course of the season. Because if you then go back to, say, the Man United game at Old Trafford, when, you know, Evan gave away two penalties, I thought they were both penalties, but they weren't dissimilar to those two for Evan. Should have got that, you know, or the Forest one thingy. But I think that was fair enough to not give that. The handball, I mean, I've seen him given. I don't know what Young can necessarily do with his arms. But I think back to, say, Amadou Inanna against Manchester City, where, again, close range, ball hit at him, not a lot of time to react. We've seen them given against Everton this season. We've also seen Everton not get penalties, from the most obvious one being Anthony Robinson at Fulham, when he had his, I mean, he had his hand outstretched away from his body, and comically, I was told it was because his hand was deemed to be, you know, by his side, which was just astonishing. I can understand the frustration with the Ashley Young one, that clearly hits his arm, and yeah, it's so subjective, that handball rule, it seems that. But obviously, again, we've seen Everton not give them or them go against Everton, so I'm happy for one to fall Evan's way. The third one, I think, is the big one, really. Again, Ashley Young, who has taken to Twitter today to taunt Nottingham Forest by sharing a screen grab of Justin Timberlake's song Cry Me a River, obviously at the centre of all three of these decisions, which is just fantastic. I think the third one's the issue. The third one's, I can see where they had the complaint, because if you watch Anthony Taylor, you know, again, it's Hudson-Odoi, he's through on goal, Young slides in, Anthony Taylor makes the, you know, in waving away the protest, he makes a decision that, he makes a gesture to suggest that he thinks Ashley Young had got the ball. Now, I think that was a perfectly reasonable conclusion to come to, seeing that live. I don't see that as a refereeing mistake as such, because it's one of those fine margin ones, ball kind of scuffs. It's very difficult to tell what's happened there. It's clear that Taylor thought that Young got some of the ball. Where I think Forest have some legitimacy in their complaints is the fact that VAR, they're mic'd up. VAR can see that Taylor has made the gesture that he's got the ball. Well, when they check it and see that Young doesn't get the ball, at that point they've probably got to send to the screen or say to Taylor, look, we know you think he got the ball. We've seen the replay, he didn't get the ball. Do you therefore want to see if you want to change your decision? I think Everton got lucky on that one, I think, really. So, you know, obviously, asked Sean Dyche about this at the end of the game. He wasn't aware of Forrest's statement at that time, and he did what I think we would all naturally do in this thing, and then go, well, I don't think decisions have quite gone Everton's way this season, and I think there's a big back catalogue of complaints that Everton can have, and whilst the complaints have been quite vociferous, they haven't quite gone as far as Forrest. But, you know, I think on other days some of those decisions could have gone against Everton, and on plenty of those days those decisions have gone against Everton. We take it when it comes back in our favour, I think.
Gavin, you got any different interpretations to that? I mean, Everton would be happy just to get three penalties in a season, never mind one afternoon. But anything to add on that?
Look, he's got away with the Young kicking out, more than I thought. I thought the handball was, I think that, seeing him given, but I think that would have been a little bit harsh. The third one was definitely a penalty for me, and I can't believe that. I mean, VAR, what's going on there? And it goes back to what I was saying before about when VAR intervenes, when you've got a leading referee. I thought that the Young one, he sort of kicks through him, doesn't he? I thought he was lucky to get away with it. But on that basis, though, I thought the Garner and DCL penalties at the time.
Decision has for me going is there is consistency. Or recent consistency, at least.
And it's not a great look, I think, when they're obviously raising the bar during the season. If you think about the Michael Keane handball at Anfield, which wasn't given by the ref and to VAR. But I thought it was lucky. And Forrest Forrest's frustration, I think, came from the accumulated frustration over three penalties that weren't given. Contractually obliged at this stage to say, Mark Clattenburg writing in national newspaper about penalties not being given at Goodison. Well, you couldn't really make that one up, could you, really?
That was a tap in for me earlier when I was asked to do a comment piece
Chris,
on that.
Do you want to explain what you
Yeah, I was asked, that wasn't even my idea. I was asked by our sub editors to do a comment piece on the back of that one, and I said he showed more brass neck than C3PO with if he's going to accuse people of having refereeing nightmares at Goodison Park. And I think I don't need to explain anymore on that score if you want to have a look at that article.
Revenge is a dish best served cold, as they say. But in all seriousness, talking about the wider game is it does tell what, like, you know, clubs employing former referees and as advisors quotes or whatever is do you think that's taken the game down a dangerous road?
It wasn't Clattenburg who sent the tweet, was it?
Do you think that's taken things down a dangerous road?
I think it's sending things down a farcical farcical road, I think, to be honest. I think as well, you know, we all know probably from the industries that we work in, and I'm sure lots of listeners will do as well, but the game can change very, very quickly. You only have to be out of the job or out of the inner workings of or off the front line of a job. And for a short period of time, you can very quickly become outdated or behind the curve. And I think there's always a danger of something like that with referees as well. And the game's changing so much and the rules are changing so much. And what's being asked of referees is being changed so much that, you know, I'm not sure how much use Clattenburg can be there. And certainly when they go nuclear so quickly, and obviously Clattenburg's come out twice now in a very short period of time and gone being very critical of the referees. Well, surely the reason that you appoint him in the first place is because you think that there's going to be some sort of benefit. And if it's not from getting the benefits of his relationship with referees or the insight that he can offer, then I'm not sure what it is, because from his insight, all these decisions are wrong. Well, he's not going to make them right. So, you know, the one consistency is that they've been wrong in every time. And, you know, if all he's doing is you know, firing shots at his, you know, former colleagues, and I'm not sure how that helps either. Be interested for your thoughts. I mean, obviously, a lot of the conversation here has been on the penalty decisions. I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting yesterday in relation to Anthony Taylor's performance was the head injury stuff. We had the situation where I think, you know, James Tarkowski was down with a head injury at one point in right at the end of the first half. Right on his goal line. They played. Forrest carried on playing on. The referee didn't stop the game, and Forrest put the ball back in the box. Had a good chance, won another corner, and I kind of thought that should have been stopped. I think that was one when Brantway go down with a head injury at one point. He played on as well, I think.
He went down. I'm not sure.
Just a few, because Nico Williams went over the sides, didn't he?
I'm not saying that. You know, emboldened Morgan Gibbs-White and Beto to perhaps go engage in that challenge as emphatically as they did, but. Yeah, I'm just interested for your thoughts, really. I thought he could have done better with some of the aerial challenges earlier on in the game.
Weren't happy with about that one.
Which might have had an impact on.
The Tarkowski one was a bit of a strange one, because players carried on. Like, I mean, he could trample on somebody in the penalty area.
James Tarkowski isn't going to fall over and lie prostrate and the. Prostrate in the area, is he, unless there's something wrong with him? You know, I know you could say, well, we can't, you know, does he know James Tarkowski or not? You don't take that as red, as knowing that the way players are going to react. I think that was one of the infamous ones. Going back to Clattenburg for 1 second, is when he didn't say send off Dirk Kuyt in that infamous derby in 2007, because he probably thought, you know, Dirk's a nice guy, he wouldn't do that. But, you know, Tarkowski isn't going to go down and make a meal or something if he's not hurt. And like Joe said, that play did continue for a long time after that one. Everyone weren't happy.
Back to Pickford then. I mean, it's a brilliant save. You know, I think that, like, I'm still amazed by the amount. I mean, I know we're all amazed by the amount of stick that Pickford gets from people outside the Evans Circle. I'm still amazed by the amount of stick he gets from inside it to a certain extent as well. Like, I mean, he does make mistakes and it does feel like they're high profile, but, you know, when I think of the last, you know, we're 3 consecutive relegation battles now, and for me, that save from Chris Wood is up there with the, perhaps not as good, but in terms of the importance, I think of that save, you know, Lampard called it the save of the Premier League era from Cesar Azpilicueta against Chelsea. That Chelsea game being that game after the Burnley defeat when Everton knew they were in a relegation battle, and the first coach welcome and the first big fan kind of showing to back the players in a relegation battle. Obviously, that was crucial to that 1-0 win. And last season, he had quite a few, but particularly in the depths, that penalty save from James Maddison, 2-1 down, going into half-time at Leicester. I think that's safe from Chris Wood's up there, because, I mean, I know Gibbs White skews it. It's coming in at the back post. He's got ground to make up. Wood absolutely hammers that from close range. Keep that out. I know it's mainly reactions, but, I mean, it takes intelligence to get across, intelligence and physical ability to make up that ground and get into a position where you might be able to make a reflex save. And, I mean, that was absolutely phenomenal.
Well, that's why he reacted the way he did.
Well, yeah.
He knew how important that was, what a save that was.
We look at the two big moments probably at the back end of the season so far, or the two big games. You classed that there yesterday as a game they really needed to win and or certainly not lose. And, yeah, that game changes if Forest equalise at half-time and it goes in at one each. And then you also look at, a couple of weeks ago, Newcastle, when he was put in a phenomenal performance to keep Everton in the game, which meant that he could get at the end. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that anybody will ever be able to look back on this period in Everton's history fondly. Like, let's be honest, it's an absolute... Yeah. It's been torture, hasn't it? It's horrible. But when we do look back on it, I hope that people are willing to give Jordan Pickford the plaudits he deserves, because I think that some of his individual performances have been the difference between Everton going up and potentially staying up and potentially going down. And it's the games that he makes them in, and the times. Like, I mean, we know he makes mistakes, but all keepers make mistakes. And probably we've seen a little bit of an insight from this in the last few weeks, because really, I mean, Trezeguet didn't exactly hit his shot cleanly yesterday. I know it was right in the corner, but I'm still a bit amazed. Like, I mean, it bounced so many times. I don't quite know how Seltzin get to it. And we've seen other goalkeeper outlets. I mean, you look at Burnley. Well, you look at Murray. Obviously, kicked the ball against Dominic Calvert-Lewin again, and then it was his fault to. So he cost Burnley 2 points against Everton, and then two points against Brighton as well. If Everton had 2 points taken off, and Burnley had one point for the draw at Everton and 2 points for the win over Brighton, added on, then all of a sudden we're in a completely different kind of scenario, and that's it. The goalkeeping isn't actually that good, I don't think, in the Premier League.
Only when Vincent keepers come to Goodison mainly at the start of the year.
That's Areola and Leno, wasn't it? I hope Pickford gets applause. And he also, what offers are on the table, can all speculate about as much as possible. He signed a new contract as soon as Dyche came in the building. That was a you could understand why he might want to drag out and see if there were any easy opportunities to go to other clubs where he might not be spending the last 3 months of every season having sleepless nights.
I'm staggered with this stick. He does get okay from the rivals. We've covered that many a times. But, I think Everton should be very grateful that that they're fighting to stay in the Premier League, and they've got the England number one goalkeeper. They've got the goalkeeper, I consider, other than the two Brazilians, to be best in the Premier League. And, they're certainly not one of the top three clubs, unfortunately, at the moment. I mean, where do you think that save would rank, Gav? Were you about to say something?
I think the time of the save was important.
Yeah.
I think, and in getting across, he sort of has this... I felt yesterday quite early on that it was... And especially when after that save, it had vibes of the 1-0 Chelsea in Man United games from 2 years ago with the Lampard, didn't it? And Pickford had his, pass head on yesterday, didn't he? And I think fair play also with Tarkowski, did very well in the aftermath of the save, didn't he?
He played it twice,
didn't he? So fair play to Tarkowski, and he's had a ropey time of it as well, and he got away with one, didn't he? When going back to Joe's point about how we look back on this period of the time, I think if Pickford's not our player of the decade, even though we're not halfway through yet, I'll be very surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, mainly because there's not a surface of candidates, to be honest with you, for reasons we all know. But he's also, he's established himself already as the clear candidate of being the best, Everton player of this era. And that maybe says a lot more about Everton than Pickford, but he's done enough to do that, I think. Yeah.
Keeping him busy.
Yeah, yeah. And I got the impression he had his game head on yesterday. Yeah. And I think that was quite apparent early on. He fluffed, there was a couple of clearances, I think he fluffed a little bit. Yeah. But
his kicking was poor. Yeah. Yeah. He dominated his area well, yeah. But his kicking seemed to have a hangover from Stamford Bridge.
He just got the impression it was Chelsea and Man United he visited from 2 years ago. And yeah. I mean, you need them, don't we? I mean, let's face it, we would have gone down, haven't we? If it wasn't for Pickford. Yeah. He'd be a championship club. And, you know, when you talk about his ability and question it and where he stands and on Premier League goalkeepers, you know, in the hierarchy, you know, if you're that important to the team that they go down, if it wasn't for you, you probably means you're pretty good and pretty important to that team. And that's even before we talk about his England heroics. On occasion, so yeah, I thought one of his better days yesterday, and he was another one who needed it after Chelsea, wasn't he? Really,
yeah, well, of course. I was talking about Idrissa Gueye being the unlikely hero for the first, but Joe, Dwight McNeil, I mean, the paintbrush was out again, and once sweeping motion of that one, like he'd done at Forest away early in the season, we'd probably like to see a lot more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a big thing that we saw at the back end of last season, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, it was McNeil and Decore's goals that kept Everton up. I mean, Idrissa Gueye played a role in the second goal. It was him that broke up the Forest attack, and really I do think he was probably the difference, because what Everton had was somebody that was breaking up attacks just as they entered the final third.
Yeah.
And Forest didn't, because both Everton, you know, Forest didn't have that kind of just sweeper on the edge of their own box, just sorting out all the loose balls, because both Everton's goals came from, you know, players having too much time and space 30 yards out at the end of the day, didn't they? And yeah, it was nice to see that from McNeil. We know he's had a very difficult season on and off the pitch, and you know, it was. Again, when you think of the best moments under Sean Dyche, you tend to think of Dwight McNeil. You think of places like Brighton last season, Brentford last season, when he scored the early goal that went on to win the game. And you know, you think of Forest away, he scored the goal that won that game during that sequence of four wins in a row. And it's just amazing that he gets that much time and space. I mean, I know Forest were pushing forward and looking for an equaliser, but, and they'd had a few warnings at that point, but. I don't know why they decided to let him have that much time and space from there, because it's something that he can do, and you know, obviously we want to see more of it, but the style of play, I think, means that too often McNeil's on the halfway line for Everton than, you know, 30 yards out and able to cut inside. So obviously, yeah, that's Dyche pragmatism for you. There isn't a lot, he doesn't have a lot of options in that squad. But it was great to see McNeil do that. You know, again, one thing that we haven't really seen from this... One thing that Everton haven't really had for a long time, probably for the last season and a half or so, is a match winner. You could maybe Pickford, but it's a very different match winning experience to the fans when you've got someone who produces a moment in a magic in front of goal to stop the other team. You know, it means you can hang on to a win.
Yeah.
Yeah, there aren't many players in that squad, and haven't been for quite some time, that can produce a moment of magic out of nothing to potentially win a game. McNeil and his left foot is one of them. Yeah. And I think it's been notable this season how little of it we've seen. But fortunately, we saw it in a very big game. On Sunday, and you know, it just sets Everton, and it sets a few of those Everton players up nicely going into, you know, the last few games of the season. Really, hopefully, just gives a bit of a confidence reboot. I think, you know, we weren't able to do a preview for Forest, but I think last week was a very, very difficult week for everybody at Finch Farm, including Dyche, and you know, the post. Post-Chelsea, I think there was a lot of introspection, reflection, and some frank conversations, which, you know, may have a, you know, long-term consequences in that dressing room. But whatever happened, they were just about able enough to, just about do enough to come out on top of Forest this season. I think that this is probably a bit of a story of the three relegation battles that Everton have been in, actually, that for all that we talk about how good the standard is in the Premier League and how wealthy it is and how it's the most popular, you know, domestic football competition in the world. For whatever reason, you know, it's also a league that inspires chaos from so many different football clubs. And when you think of when you think how chaotic things have been at Everton, how unstable things have been at Everton, certainly for the last 3 years, the fact that for probably a third season in a row they're not going to be in the worst three of those sides. Probably tells you a lot about kind of the state of, you know, the deeper state, I think, of the top end of the English game, and, you know, the gulf between the Premier League and the Championship, and the money that's at stake, and how much the riches are a bit of a trap that, you know, entice people into making poor decisions and instability and chaos. And obviously Everton are one of the clubs that have fallen foul of that, but yeah, they're also probably one of, not going to be one of the nine sides that gets relegated when Everton have been at their lowest ebb. So
yeah, I mean, we're off on a bit of a different tangent there, Gav.
Yeah, sorry.
But to make a good point, but I would, because yeah, I was just going to ask you about Dwight McNeil as well, because I mean, like, Everton don't have many creative players. We all know that, and that is something. Hopefully, we've talked about Dominic Calvert-Lewin with this, in that he's a player with a, you know, can get his eye in with a purple patch. McNeil can be like that a bit as well. So you've got to hope that maybe after getting this one, there might be some other ones in the locker on the horizon.
2-1 with the Premier League game yesterday, wasn't it? Right. You know, see the number of goals he scored. It's like less than 1 in 10, I think. Something like that. For somebody with his ability on the left foot and his ability to craft things and for himself, I think that's a bit that's underperforming that, I think, from a goal scoring side. And but at the same time, gonna you know, argue against that by saying, I've said this before on the pod, you know, we haven't got many players you'd describe as match winners, but I think McNeil can fit into that category. I think he's got the ability to do that. I also get the argument that actually maybe his best position is just behind the striker, where he can, you know, he's got a little bit more.
He was doing a lot of that yesterday.
I sort of get that. I just don't think he's got the pace to be
I disagree, Ajax. Okay. I think the problem that he's got playing central is he's so heavily one-footed. I mean, if you look at, say, for instance, the one of the Brighton goals with hat-trick last season, where, I mean, you know, he was 2 yards out of an open goal, he still ran all the way around the ball to so he could kick with his left foot.
I did actually ask him, was there any chance he was going to do that? He's right, and he went,
I just thought he was milking the moment by celebrating in front of the fans, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, like, I think to be central, I think you need to be...
a little bit two-footed, I get that, and, you know, to give... You don't, defenders don't know where you're going. I sort of get that. I do get that, why you would say that. Is the core 82-footed? I don't know. And he plays sometimes behind the striker. So I thought he worked really hard yesterday. Going back to what I said at the start of the pod, I felt the 4-1-4-1 helped the two wide players yesterday. Because he had a little bit, you know, a few more players around him when he got the ball. And, Harrison looked far more effective. Whether we deploy that on Wednesday is a moot point. But yeah, McNeil, it's good to see him. We all know he's had a difficult time off the pitch. We should remember that. But, you know, he can strike a ball well, and he should be scoring more goals, I think. And he deserved that one yesterday for his performance.
Yeah, just before we finish on that, we'll have a look forward to the derby. Just wanted to mention about Sean Dyche and his costume change, as it were. You can't see us at the moment. I've got my tie on. Gav's got his shirt on, but open neck. And Joe's got something else on. I don't know. What would you describe that as, Joe? What you're wearing there?
It's a bit harsh, I think.
It's like a zip jacket, but it's not a tracky top, though, is it?
It's not a tracky top.
No, it's very similar to one I've
got. I'm just trying to paint a picture here for the listeners, because they can't see us today.
I'd say I'm more pitch side pundit. That's
where I am. So what did you make of Sean Dyche's sartorial elegance, or perhaps lack of it, yesterday after his change? Ditching of the shirt and tie.
You know, I mean, she spoke before the game about ringing the changes. I think there was a bit of an attitude shift, I think, at Finch Farm in the week. I mean, I wasn't expecting it to go so down to the details as what Dyche was wearing. But, you know, if he was hoping to force a bit of luck and a bit of change, obviously, he did it. Yeah. So I think the players found it quite amusing. He was asked about it in his post-match press conference.
By which point he'd actually changed into shorts as well, because he had the tracksuit bottoms on the touchline, and he had the shorts on by the time he saw us.
That's it. it was a big win for Sean Dyche. I was at Finch Farm last week for the pre-match press conference, and I thought there was a significant change in attitude from Dyche. I thought he looked like he'd been shaken by what happened at Chelsea, and perhaps the reaction to it. And, for once, it felt like, you know, he looked a little bit vulnerable.
Yeah.
Which is very rare for Sean Dyche. It's not something that we've seen. And as much as we've talked about, you know, and I've written about him openly criticising or questioning the players post-Chelsea, he also acknowledged that he'd done that of himself a little bit as well. So it's an interesting one. It'll be an interesting one to see what the broader impacts of that Chelsea defeat are, you know, going for Everton longer term, because I also think that, yeah, I think the fan base has been split for a long time on Dyche, and, you know, again, it felt like there was a bit of a surge in the number of people questioning him and being willing to give him less of a benefit of the doubt for the kind of the wider context in which he's operating this season. I think he probably knew that as well, and knew that he could only have so many answers to that weren't wins on the pitch. Well, now he's got one. Yeah. You know, his setup yesterday was interesting. Some of it was forced. Amadou Inanna didn't come on after being taken off at half-time at Chelsea. I think that's an interesting. We know that Dyche doesn't like to make substitutions if he thinks things are going well, but obviously didn't turn to him at all, whereas he did turn to the likes of, well, I was going to say Chimiti then, but Chimiti came off a better.
James Garner came on.
But James Garner come on. Starting Andre Gomes, I thought, was interesting. I think it worked in the end. I think it was nice to see Andre Gomes. He wants the ball so much. But I also think that better sides would have had a lot more joy against that midfield. It was the kind of Idrissa Gueye sitting, and then you had Gomes and Doucouré in front of him, and I don't think I think between the two of them, they didn't quite have the discipline to. There was a lot of, I'm not sure where I'm going to press, and if one presses, I don't know if the other one goes, and every now and then Idrissa Gueye would leap forward, but then no one would cover him back. I think the better sides might have made more of the opportunities that they're there. I made the mistake of, after about 15 minutes, saying how much I was enjoying watching Andre Gomes play. And I think it was like he comes so deep for the ball and he helps him move up the pitch. And it's just so nice seeing someone with that much composure and elegance on the ball. That's lovely. But he did put every set piece into the first man.
One he overhit, wasn't he?
Well, the one he overhit, I think he'd gone to pick up the ball from the centre backs and managed to kind of lead the move to gradually get Everton all the way up to the edge of the Burnley area. And it was like, oh my God, we're watching an Everton team play with the ball on the floor for a little bit. And he won the free kick. When he steps up to take the free kick, you're thinking, well, I'm thinking this could be a landmark Gomes, before, and then he just drifts it about 4 yards.
It's like he had the sand wedge when he needed the putter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I know the third one, which is the one he took from the main stand side, is, you always get onto the negative of it, but no, it's always funny because behind me, they're all having bets, he's going to over it. This or Bender, you over it, because he'd done the priest, then he just hit the face, man. I was like, one of them, but I thought he did okay. But I get your point, Joe, that Forrest tend to go down the wings a little bit more, so you could probably leave a little bit of space in midfield, but against the better teams,
there are still big issues. That's great. We didn't do a pre Forrest one, but I mean, I really would be looking at playing James Garner at right back for the rest of the season. I think he is the best right back option ever having that squad. Certainly even more so in a position at the minute when you've got Coleman and, I mean, Pat Southampton looking, but those two are out injured, and you've got a situation where you've got five fit central midfielders fighting for competition. You had that fact, and I think Garner has struggled recently. I think that's probably because of the workload. He's been ever present all season. You know, he has been worked to the very bone. I think there's enough cover there for Dyche to be able to go, oh, my hand was forced if it doesn't work out. But I think Everton would actually be stronger. Garner played at right back, and he still have four players to choose from centre midfield there. I know we're all making a joke about Ashley Young and things like that, and his Crimea River thing and stuff like that, and we can all laugh at Nottingham Forest. I mean, on another day, he gave away a few fouls anyway. On another day, he could very easily have given away a penalty that, either a silly penalty at 0-0, which puts Everton behind in a big game, and we know how bad they are at chasing games. An unlucky penalty at one each on half time, which would have been unlucky, but we've seen them given, or, you know, a penalty that potentially concedes momentum right at the beginning of the second half as well. And, you know, I think we have to judge all those players in the context in which they're operating. Like, it's a poor squad that's on its knees, got lots of injuries, under a huge amount of psychological pressure, and pressure they don't deserve to be in because because those players, in fairness to them, have got the points that mean that Everton shouldn't be in a relegation battle now. So, yeah, that mood should have been, that pressure should have been lifted a long time ago. And if it had done, you know, if Everton hadn't got those 8 points taken off them and hadn't spent most of the start of this year thinking they had 10 points taken off them, then they wouldn't have gone. I don't for one second think they'd have gone 13 without a win. I think it would have given them the freedom to pick up a few more. And then all of a sudden, without those off the pitch issues, this same group of players that we've got so many, or I've got so many question marks over, there aren't just 14, maybe they're 12. And all of a sudden, maybe Everton are, you know, that would put them, what, 4 or 5 places higher. They might be £15-16 million better off in merit payments at the end of the season. And all of a sudden, next season starts to change. So I think all that is important. But, you know, I also think we probably, going into the last few games of the season, I think we'll be okay, but just need to bear all that in mind. And I hope that's something that, even if Everton start to pull away now, which they might not do against Wednesday, I think they've got a chance of taking points in the derby, I do. They've certainly got a chance of taking points from a Brentford team that are now safe. But I really hope that, say, for instance, Everton continue to have a very good week, that nobody is in under any illusions there at Finch Farm, that it still doesn't need a whole lot of the work doing on that squad.
Yeah, well, Joe's right-back concerns does bring us to the derby, Gav, because, of course, Ashley Young was sent off at Anfield in the reverse fixture. I mean, personally, I think he's actually keeps out of trouble when he's right mid rather than right back, and as Joe mentioned, I mean, how would you change it then? And obviously, we wish Beto well. He won't be involved after his concussion.
It's but Calvert-Lewin injured, do we know?
That's an easy came off with. It wasn't a concern over his hamstring, which is what kept him out in the game before. It was Clash and Easy came off, so they're hoping it's not serious.
He's only got a couple of days to recover,
The interesting thing is, and there's comments, I was saying this before we came in, that a week of 3 home matches, and the one that's probably the least important is the derby. Yeah, it could be argued.
I've had this discussion myself. You can't say it, but everyone knows and understands it.
And it's a bit of an odd game, this, for me, for many reasons.
I made a joke last week, and I kind of started almost to believe it when I said it, that, you know, following obviously Liverpool's struggles last week, knocked out the Europa League, and, you know, they dropped points against Manchester United, and following Everton's thing, Derby was one of the most important games of Liverpool's season that was left, whereas for Everton, it probably wasn't. There's an argument to say it's not in the top three when you put in Forest, Luton and Sheffield United in the situation that they're in.
There's far more pressure on the red side than the blue side, in a strange way, when you see the league positions. It's odd, but I'd argue that's the case. And I'm just wondering if that might inform some of our selection. Questions.
Shuffle the pack a bit.
If there is a question mark over it, like a Calvert-Lewin, whereas previously he may have wanted to play him in the derby, might think, well, actually, Saturday's a little bit more important.
Yeah, get him ready for Brentford.
And this is one of the problems, having 3 games in 6 days, and I get that. So there's a couple of things there. I get the Garner call at right back, but has he played right back for us this season?
I don't think he has this season. He played against Bournemouth in the last game of last season.
Didn't have any full-backs.
He was there for England in the European Championship.
It's possibly a big ask to ask somebody first time in the season to play against Liverpool. I get that you probably 4-1-4-1 you get overrun the midfield against Liverpool. So I can see maybe Ronaldo comes off the naughty step. Liverpool may be at home, maybe the type of game you'd expect them to flourish and, you know, be up for and so on.
Well, one thing that is we haven't seen a huge amount of Chimita. Obviously, we know he's got the size to be it, but one thing Everton wouldn't have Dominic Calvert-Lewin isn't playing, they won't have the target man if they can't play either Calvert-Lewin or Beto. So that might force a bit of a change and approach that might help Anana if it's more on the ball and in the middle of the pitch, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know, there's a few positional places, I think, that are possibly up for grabs. And I think possibly we'll change a little bit from Wednesday. But I think it's just an interesting game, this, for us.
Okay.
And it's put a far more interesting game for Liverpool.
Do we stick our necks out then? And then
I think one thing that I do think changes some of the calculations on there is probably also that what happened at Chelsea, and the fact that there is such a recent thrashing against a side that they were not at the races against. I think, yeah, that was a chastening experience for everyone. And I hope that there are people at the club that are well aware of the optics of, you know, even if, given the situation after that that win over Forest, Everton, probably big favourites to go up, and this is to stay up, sorry, and this is a game in hand, and whatever happens, it's not a game that is like to relegate Everton. I mean, it really would be a case of back to square one a week ago.
If they cannot,
I don't think they can afford. And I think they had a taste of this last week. I don't think Dyche can afford to get battered again.
No. There's the long term implications for that for Dyche, isn't there? But I you probably, you know, keep it tight. Yeah. You know,
and that's not me saying that. Obviously, you'd go if they got battered. So I don't think
No.
But I think in terms of, you know, his relationship, his long term relationship with the fan base.
Well, especially because you've got a home game 3 days later as well. So it's not as if you've not got a home game for 2 weeks. You've got another home game three days later, which is important. So, yeah, I get that. He'll probably play a lot tighter, certainly than what he did on Saturday, and that might inform some of his options, really.
I'm not going to ask any of you to do something I wouldn't. Then I'll go first, then, and I will predict a Derby scoreline of 0-0.
Yeah, maybe get one each.
They've been very tight games. Got to stop the last five is a four draws or something.
That's
like that.
Is, guys. Yeah, but you win.
Yeah, goalless last season, wasn't it? They obviously had two on the COVID, and we've had a couple of goalless games, haven't we? I think goalless is probably a good one actually to go with. That could be a bit frantic, by the way. If it's goalless the last 5 minutes and they need to score, that could
feels
be
like
very
it could be a very nervous game from everyone, doesn't it? Like,
one each.
I went into this week. I'll be perfectly honest. I was terrified of the Nottingham Forest game. I thought the likes of Alanga and Gibbs White and Everton come off the back of that Chelsea game. I thought that whilst I was and still am confident that Everton would stay up, I didn't think that they'd get the job done against Forest. I actually started this week, and people probably laugh at me, fair enough, being a little bit more confident of Everton in the derby than against the Forest game, just because of football and the pressures and the, obviously that we know there's a big disparity between the ability of the two sides, but obviously we also know that football is about so much more than that sometimes, and we see that to dramatic effect at times, and I kind of almost, part of me always wonders as well, and again, you know, started off by saying things fell the right way for Everton at the start of the season, whereas too often they haven't done. There's always part of me which thinks that this club has been in this fan base has gone through so much suffering over the course of this season that maybe the karma might be a home derby win, but
with a dodgy penalty.
With a dodgy penalty. That's it. That'll be it then.
VAR gets scrapped forever. Okay, on that bombshell. I've been your host, Chris Beasley. I've been joined by Joe Thomas, Gavin Buckland. This has been the Royal Blue Podcast.